Hello and welcome, and thank you for joining us today on the Web.Guys radio show. And my name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana over here, ready to turn your tech world upside down.
Oh, whatever, Dana.
All right.
Glad to have you joining us this week as we navigate the future of the net, from Google hacks to even Webby nominations.
To the Dirty Dozen viruses, that is. To being one of the eight people shaping the internet.
Oh my goodness, I definitely want to be one of those eight. A couple of things on our website this week are new and at webtalkguys.com, so go check it out. First, we've got a streaming video from a local TV show that has featured the Web Talk Guys in their story, so you want to go definitely check that out. The story covers a city-owned broadband cable provider, and we kind of give our little comments about how great broadband is.
We also finally decided to jump on the weblog bandwagon. We just started our own Web.Guys blog. That's linked from our front page, and there you can read what happens to us between our weekly shows during the week.
Well, I guess we had to do the weblog eventually, right?
Well, we're trying. We have a couple entries.
Well, we're an audio blog anyway, right? So we've been doing it all along.
Hmm.
Well, we definitely hope that you like the show that we're bringing you. Today, we're basically going to cover a significant amount of information about the coming Webby Awards. It's time for them to award all their great little trophies again. And the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences has announced the nominations this week for their Webby Awards coming up in June. The Webbies are an annual recognition of this year's best websites in 30 categories, including activism, community, film, news, personal websites, and politics and radio. And we're going to speak with Maya Drazen, and she is the executive director of the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, and she's also the president of the Webby Awards.
The Webby Awards are scheduled for June 7th in San Francisco at a place called Teatro Zanzani, which is a fabulous old cabaret dinner theater. And it's, like last year, an intimate event which focused mostly on the nominees and the Academy members and the community that's there. And we're really excited. Joan Baez will be making a special appearance there as the host.
I'm sure you know the web is a wealth of information, and I'm sure you use it to do a lot of research. But it's not always as easy as it sounds. In fact, it's pretty common to get a lot of misses as well as hits when you're using a search engine. So today, we're going to find out a few tricks to get the most out of, let's just say it, Google, because we all use Google.
Yes, we do.
There's a new book that focuses just on that called Google Hacks. It has lots of tips and tricks to help you find what you want. We'll be joined by the co-author of Google Hacks, Rael Dornfest, and he promises to give us a whole bunch of useful advice to make your surfing much more effective.
I think because Google is this big, mysterious beastie, that it's an oracle of sorts. You tell it and it returns back, and it's just fascinating. People are dying to know how it works. They're also dying to fiddle with it and try and change the way it works. There are some folks doing that. So in our book, we were always careful to do, for example, we cover Google whacking, which is, you know, putting in the fewest number of words, and real words, where you would end up with one result only. Incredibly hard to do, actually, because the combination of the words that have been used in pages is obviously huge.
Some important news from around the net this week. They're searching for eight people to shape the future of the internet and the Dirty Dozen viruses.
The ICANN organization, and that acronym refers to the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, has decided that they need to have an additional eight people join their board of directors, and they put out a request for people to volunteer.
Now, in case you don't know, ICANN is a nonprofit body created back in 98 to help take over from the United States government the Internet's operating framework. So, you know, things they've done, such as introduce competition into the sale of the internet domain names, so that's why you see Register and GoDaddy now, not just Network Solutions. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that brought us the new domain suffixes like .info, .biz, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But Rob, tell us some specifics about this nominating committee.
Well, this nominating committee is looking worldwide for people that can join the board and kind of take ICANN and its future direction. And they're actually looking for eight positions on the board of directors, five positions on their at-large advisory committee. they're actually looking to grow this organization and make it more influential around the world, and they're looking for fresh input into the organization. The submissions need to be made by May 5th. So if you have an interest in it, that's your deadline. And they'll have some people selected by June, basically. And basically what they're looking for is a person that has credibility within the online area and is also aware of ICANN's inner functions.
So I suggest go to ICANN.org. You'll find the information on nominating yourself or someone else there, but it's important to read the mission and their overall sort of goals so you're familiar with that as well. That would be pretty cool because some of the perks are international travel.
Yes, it is.
And, of course, just a great thing to have on your resume.
But I think it's also a big responsibility, too. So I think, it's a pretty important organization. I think it's going to become more important over time.
This is not just jargon when they say you're going to shape the future of the Internet.
This is the closest organization to the governing body of the Internet.
Yet they refuse to ever. In fact, they'll shout it from the mountaintops
exactly.
That they are not the government of the Internet. But you know.
But who is?
Who is?
If they're not, who is?
Well, Rob, there's a dirty dozen out there, and it's not Clint Eastwood.
It's the top 12 list of the dirtiest viruses out there.
So there's a company called Central Command, who just happens to be an antivirus software company, but they do keep track of the occurrences of viruses that they see through their little virus response team. And the top two have been the top two for the last 5 months. What are they, Rob?
Well, there's, like Dana said, there's two of them. It's one is the Klies E virus, and the other one is the Yaha E virus, which are viruses that come in your inbox, and they usually come disguised as like screensavers, and actually they've morphed into a lot of different varieties, as viruses do. You know, they adapt to changing environments. But the Klies E virus has accounted for about 21.6% of all total viruses that are infecting computers online, and the Yaha E, which has total about 10.8%. So now, it's significant.
What I think is interesting is some of the new viruses that have appeared this month, they're not yet in the top 10, but just because they sort of hang on the current situation going on in Iraq. One is called Worm Ganda, and it's an internet worm that's socially engineered to capitalize on the world's current interest in the Mideast. And so basically, there'll be a screensaver attached saying it has pictures of U.S. spy satellite pictures taken over the mission over Iraq. And so don't click on it, okay? The other one is, I love the names that they associated with these worms. Nice Hello is a worm that actually is written in Spanish, but it attacks, oh, this is clever, the MSN Messenger contact list. Well, that's been done plenty of times. It's either that or Outlook.
Well, that's essentially the same thing as going after an Outlook contact list, because the MSN Messenger uses email addresses within it too. So they're actually doing a combination of instant messenger messages as well as email is what it appears that is going on here.
It's kind of interesting that the names of some of these worms, like of the Dirty Dozen, the number four in that position is Avril, which I'm sure is
Avril Lavigne. Yeah.
You know, not that she has anything to do with it. Yeah. Number five is So Big. I think you can figure out what they're talking about there. And number eight is Fun Love, another catchy little phrase.
Yes. And actually, there's a couple on this list, actually three of them that have been big viruses in the past that are still showing up, and that's the CIRCAM C, which is about 1.7%. So it's definitely getting beat back by the antivirus software that's out there, but it's still hanging in. There's still a significant amount of people that still don't have the antivirus software.
Yeah, that's why the top two have been the top two for 5 months. People aren't like saying, okay, antivirus software, come save me.
And the 11th one is the NIMDA virus, which is 1.4%, and the Badtrans B, which has been around for a long time at 1.1%. So hopefully some of the ones that are higher up on this list will get beaten back by the antivirus software over time.
Beat them back.
Yeah.
Just send our military in on them. Hey, Rob, you know, we have to go to a break in a second, but I just want to take a time out, a little second here, because I wanted to share with you guys that we have a new sponsor on the WebTalk Guys show.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're really happy to have them here, and that's Jay Olson of Sea Silver, but we actually use this product. So we just wanted to make that known because he's been a listener of our show for a while, and Sea Silver is something that we use. It's a way to sort of drink your vitamins and minerals as opposed to popping a pill, which I don't particularly like to do.
Well, it certainly makes sense that taking a liquid is a more efficient way of getting your vitamins because, you know, most vitamins are a hard-formed tablet that you know it's got to be difficult for your body to digest. And if it's liquid, it's just going to get absorbed.
Yeah.
So it definitely makes sense.
Well, and the thing I do, and I haven't been taking my vitamins, and I sit in front of the computer way, way, way too much, and I don't get my exercise. So I kind of rely on coffee every day, large cups of coffee, to sort of fake out my body and make me think that I'm energetic and healthy. And I know that that's not true, but it feels good anyway. Well, I've kind of found myself passing up the coffee because the Sea Silver, and by the way, it's cranberry juice flavored, and I'm a freak for cranberry juice. I like that. So it tastes like that. It has really made me feel like I have more stamina, and I haven't had to have my coffee either.
Well, so, I think it must have some little stimulant in there then to make up for it.
Well, maybe. But it's got a lot of vitamins and minerals. So when we go to break, just listen for Joel's phone number. It's in the commercial. Give him a call or you can click on webtalkguys.com. We have a little link to his site. And honestly, I like this stuff. And have you ever heard me talk about sponsors on the show like this? I haven't.
No, we don't do
that.
We
just play the
very
commercials.
Often.
Yeah. And so enough said.
Yeah.
That means it means something to me.
Exactly. Stay with us, because joining us in a minute is Maya Drazen, who's the president of the Webby Awards, and she's going to talk about this year's nominations that were announced this week for the 7th Annual Webby Awards. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
Recognize that sound? If you're taking vitamins in a pill form, that's exactly where they're ending up. Hello, my name is Dr. David Friedman. According to the physician's desk reference, vitamins in a pill form are just 10% absorbed. So for every $100 you spend on vitamins, you are literally flushing $90 of it down the toilet. If you want to start absorbing the nutrients you swallow, you need to take a product called Sea Silver. Not only does it contain every vitamin, mineral, amino acid, and enzyme known to man, but because it's in a natural liquid form, it offers a 98% absorption. That means your body gets to keep the nutrients you swallow. Try delicious-tasting Sea Silver today. You'll feel a difference or your money back. Call 1-800-285-8963. That's 1-800-285-8963. Isn't it time you stopped flushing your vitamins down the toilet? 1-800-285-8963.
The Web Talk Guys, here and now.
Welcome back to the Web Talk Guys World Radio Show. And my name is Rob Greenlee, and I'm joined by Web Girl Dana. Today, we're getting all fired up about the Webby Awards, because it's time for the Webby Awards again. And the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences has announced the nominations for the 7th Annual Webby Awards. The Webbies are an annual recognition for the year's best websites in about 30 categories, including activism, community, film, news, personal websites, politics, and radio, and a whole bunch more. We are fortunate to have Maya Drazen joining us right now from San Francisco. She is the executive director of the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, and she's the president of the Webby Awards. Maya, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
The 7th Annual Webby Awards are coming up very soon again, and why don't you tell us when they are and where they are and how the event's going to unfold this year.
The Webby Awards are scheduled for June 7th in San Francisco at a place called Teatro Zanzani, which is a fabulous old cabaret dinner theater. And it's, like last year, an intimate event which focused mostly on the nominees and the Academy members and the community that's there. And we're really excited. Joan Baez will be making a special appearance there as the host.
Terrific. You've announced some nominations here this past week, and why don't you talk about maybe a category that's your favorite?
Well, I try not to choose favorites, but there usually there's always one that catches my eye. And
sure.
This year, I'm really interested in community. I think it is one of those categories that tends to change frequently. But this year, the thing that struck me is that instead of just bringing people online to talk together, there are several sites in this category that are bringing people online to meet offline, or to interact or to do something offline, which I think is just fascinating. There's meetup.com, which has been in the press quite a lot lately for the event that happened around Howard Dean, the Democratic candidate for president, and Nervous Industries, which does like a message in the bottle where they put stuff out over snail mail and then track it via the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And then geocaching, which actually uses global positioning software to do like a scavenger hunt in the real world. So I think that's really fascinating.
What changes have happened, do you think, over the past year to these categories? Are the sites different in any way, or are a lot of the sites the same as what we've seen over the last couple of years?
The Web Awards always has a nice blend of old familiar favorites like Google and eBay and Amazon, which just year after year continue to do, and ESPN, which continue to do amazing stuff. And then, you know, they just maintain their standard of excellence. And then, of course, every year there's these newbies that nobody's ever heard of that come in out of nowhere, or gems, and I love that balance. So as far as whether I think sites have changed, I think that in general they continue to get more sophisticated no matter whether they're made by the individual or by a large organization. But the thing that really excites me this year is that they seem to be getting more democratic. And by that, I mean that they're really providing tools to people to interact, to organize, to communicate, to kind of get involved. And especially in these crazy times, I think it's really important.
So let's talk a little bit about the judging process that you guys go through to select all these sites and to come up with these nominees. What is the typical criteria that you guys go through when your judges review a list of nominated sites? And how does that process really work in its nuts and bolts? Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. The judges evaluate on six criteria of good web development. And those are, you know, great content, attractive visual design, a well-thought-out structure and navigation, how much interactivity they use, how well they use the medium, and how well the site works. And then just generally, like, what a user experiences with it. We have a three-tiered judging process. People can enter their sites, and then those are reviewed by professional reviewers who pull out a short list that are passed on to the nominating judges. And then the nominating judges deliberate online and can add ideas of their own so that we're certain that we're really getting the best that people know of, both by opening it up to things that people might not know of and then just guaranteeing that there's some great stuff in there. Then finally, once the nominees are announced, we have the Academy vote in groupings on certain categories. So it's all balloting is audited by PricewaterhouseCoopers. It's a really, you know, it takes about 9 months in its entirety. So it's really thoughtful and clearly evaluated.
Let's talk a little bit about the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, and since that's really in some ways your focus because you're the executive director of that organization, can you tell us a little bit about that organization and how it works in conjunction with the Webby Awards?
Sure. There's about 480 members of the Academy, and they really range from luminaries in a particular category, like musicians Beck and David Bowie, or business people like Larry Ellison and Rob Glaser, Anita Roddick. It's really, that really runs the gamut. And to internet developers and journalists all over the world, including yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things that's really unique about this academy is that we don't think that the only people who should be evaluating good web development are people solely in the industry, that the expertise that one has in each of these categories from the traditional media really is important in evaluating the new medium.
Certainly being a judge myself this year in the radio category kind of put me in a unique position to kind of see that whole inside process, and it appears to be fairly organic at the beginning phases, but then when the judges kind of start crunching the nominees, they kind of get down to some really nuts and bolts type stuff of how the site works and how it functions and the usability. How important is that really in the evaluation of the site? And
well, we really believe that those criteria are the building blocks of good web development.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, one's experience with a website is somewhat subjective. So as you describe it, you know, it starts out in a more organic, subjective manner in the discussion of the sites. you know, what appeals to people. But when it comes down to actually voting, it's so difficult to pick five out of all the great websites out there.
Yeah,
and
I had a really difficult time making that last cut, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really tough job, and I think if you don't bring it down to objective standards, then you're doing a disservice, really, because it's such a fine line between five and six, for goodness sakes, you know, alone.
I definitely found that, you know, like in the top 10 or whatever it was, that there was such a fine line of a difference between all of those sites that I was looking at. Some had strengths in one area that the other one was weak in, and, you know, how do you judge one is more important than the other as far as a functionality or a usability technique? And I found that very difficult. But, you know, looking at it from a overall standpoint, that's really was the only way that I could really come up with, you know, that top list.
Well, that's where the final criteria overall experience really comes into play, is that, you know, frequently things are greater than the sum of their parts.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk a little bit about the People's Voice Awards. You guys have another aspect of this that gets the web surfer involved. Why don't you tell us about how that process works?
Well, and I encourage all of your listeners to go check it out and vote. From the very beginning, so 7th annual Webby Awards, we've had the 7th annual People's Voice Awards as well. We believe that on the internet in particular, every bit is important to understand what the people believe is best, as well as what the experts, the academy, believe is best. So when we announce nominees, we also launch the People's Voice voting. It runs now through May 23rd, and anyone can go online and cast their vote for their favorites in all 30 categories from one of our nominees or write in any of their own. And in the last 2 years, there's actually been several successes in writing candidates winning the People's Voice Award category. And then people have done some really crazy things to campaign. Last year there was a New Zealand site in science that launched a nationwide campaign for People's Voice and ended with a fireworks display. So, you know, you can go crazy, but I encourage everyone to vote because it's a lot of fun.
Thinking back over the last couple of years, you guys have been doing this People's Voice Award. How often has it been where the People's Voice Awards winner was the same as the Academy's selection?
They're infrequently the same. It's about, usually there's about 3 to 5 that are identical.
That's a fairly small group of judges that can judge those sites, and I'm sure that there's, you know, if you start looking at the mass amount of web surfers out there, they have a better selection or a better viewpoint, I guess.
Well, they're looking for something very different, I think, you know.
Oh, you think so? Okay.
Well, I do. I think, I mean, so the, I really look at the People's Voice as much as the loyalty issue as I do. I mean, who knows what they're evaluating? I know what the Academy is evaluating against. They're evaluating against these standards of excellence. And to me, the People's Voice Award is as much about, if there's a combination, there's people who are learning about new sites, right, who are actually going through the category and casting their votes. And then there's people who love a particular site and are there to support it. And so that's as much a loyalty issue, which I think is equally as important.
So do you guys see the same sites popping up in the nomination list every year, or is there a good rotation of sites?
It's always a nice combination. I mean, there's some old standbys, eBay, Amazon, Google, The Onion, which is there year
that's a
after
fun site.
Year.
I always enjoy that one.
Yeah, I love The Onion. And ESPN, those sites come back year after year because they just continue to maintain the highest standards of excellence and continue to evolve and keep up and lead, actually. And then, but there's always just half the sites that are new. Mm-hmm. To the Webbies and sometimes new to the internet community, that it's always fun to uncover.
So are you seeing more sites coming from Europe and Asia being a part of the award ceremony and that whole international flavor? Is that growing and developing?
Yeah, that's just been really great to see. The last 2 years, we've really seen a worldwide web. This year, we had record-breaking international numbers. We had 24 international nominees and nominees from 20 of the United States. So the epicenter has definitely moved, and I think that's fantastic. Fantastic.
The web has always been called the World Wide Web, but I think it's only been the last couple of years that it's really been a World Wide Web.
Yeah, it's in the last couple of years that we've seen. I mean, there was always development in other places, but developed at the same standard has definitely been the last 2 years, and just really some great stuff coming from all over the world.
Let's talk a little bit about your business awards. When is that going to be? And I know that's a new thing for you guys this year.
Yeah, for the first time this year, we launched the first annual Webby Business Awards. They'll be in the fall. The winners will be announced in the fall. Mm-hmm. And for this case, we're awarding for the best business practices online. So entries are being accepted now through May 30th and in 14 industry categories and 6 business objective categories.
Perfect.
And we're really looking not only at the website, but for the result against strategic objectives.
Mm-hmm.
So people have to submit a strategic brief as well. And we're really excited about this because, you know, there's so much talk about the Internet crash. And at the same time, the Internet is going nowhere. I mean, it's here to stay.
Yeah.
And the people who are left, we think, are doing things right. And understanding what they're doing that's so great and putting that back out there, I think, is going to be really useful to the industry.
The Webby Awards are coming up in June, and I'm sure that some of our listeners would maybe like to fly in and attend down in San Francisco. What opportunities are there for that?
The Webby Awards is, unfortunately, an invite-only affair.
Okay.
So it's really developed to bring the community of the nominees and the people who judged them and the people who supported this together to celebrate that accomplishment. But, of course, it's all posted online on June 5th mm-hmm. for everyone else to see. So we encourage people to come and check out the winners on June 5th and celebrate them yourself.
Plus, even last year, you guys had the audio and video available as a stream off your site as well.
We did clips and pics following the event so that people could see what happened.
We actually aired your guys' entire event last year.
That is true.
So it was terrific having that opportunity. But, well, Maya, it was great having you on the show.
It was great to be here, Rob. Thanks so much.
Thanks for giving us an update on the Webby Awards and the terrific work that you guys are doing down there.
Thanks so much.
Definitely are supportive of you, and I know all of our listeners love what you guys do too, so terrific.
Well, we appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Maya Drazen, who's Executive Director of the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, and she's also the President of the Webby Awards, and she's been giving us an update on what's happening with the Webby Awards out there, and we look forward to going to that event, hopefully, and actually seeing those award winners coming in on the June 5th.
June 5th.
Yeah, that's right. And if you want to get more information about the Webby Awards and cast your People's Voice Awards vote, go to webbyawards.com. Take care, Maya, and I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Rob. Great talking with you.
Stay connected. Joining us in a moment is Rael Dornfest, who's the author of a new book called Google Hacks. Rael is going to share lots of tips and tricks to help you find out how to use Google more efficiently and get to their hidden secrets within their database. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
Recognize that sound? If you're taking vitamins in a pill form, that's exactly where they're ending up. Hello, my name is Dr. David Friedman. According to the physician's desk reference, vitamins in a pill form are just 10% absorbed. So for every $100 you spend on vitamins, you are literally flushing $90 of it down the toilet. If you want to start absorbing the nutrients you swallow, you need to take a product called Sea Silver. Not only does it contain every vitamin, mineral, amino acid, and enzyme known to man, but because it's in a natural liquid form, it offers a 98% absorption. That means your body gets to keep the nutrients you swallow. Try delicious-tasting Sea Silver today. You'll feel a difference or your money back. Call 1-800-285-8963. That's 1-800-285-8963. Isn't it time you stopped flushing your vitamins down the toilet? 1-800-285-8963.
Get your .com drama right here, right now on the Web Talk Guys World Radio Show.
And I gotta tell you, fellas, you have got what appears to be a dynamite sound.
This is Web Talk Guys Radio, and thank you for listening today. My name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana over here. Well, as you know, the web has a wealth of information that you can access at any time to help you research. But that's not always as easy as it kind of sounds. It's really common to have as many misses in your results as you have hits because the web is really this huge shifting mass of data, and sometimes it's not always credible or useful when you find it. Now, Google is one of my favorite search engine tools and to do research. It indexes about 2.4 billion web pages. So the key to a good Google search is to know how to zero in on exactly what you want, Rob.
Yes, we are going to spend the entire next segment here, finding out a few tricks to get the most out of Google. A new book entitled Google Hacks is a collection of 100 tips, tricks, and scripts that you can use to become more effective and efficient in your research utilizing Google. Each hack can be read in just a few minutes and can save you hours of searching for the right answers. We're joined by co-author of Google Hacks, Rael Dornfest. And Rael is a researcher at O'Reilly & Associates. He basically works with programs and writes for the O'Reilly Network and the O'Reilly Publications. He is a program chair of the O'Reilly Emerging Technology Conference and is a chair of the RSS Dev Working Group and is a developer of Meerkat, an open wire service. And he also has a weblog called Royalty Bytes, and that is at www.raelity.org. Rael, thank you for joining us on the show. It's great to have you on.
Glad to be here.
Hey, let's talk about your book, Google Hacks, and why don't you tell a little bit about why you chose that name and why hacking is a term that can be applied to Google of all places.
Well, certainly. So hacking has got a bad reputation, a bad rap, if you will, for being associated with some with breaking things, or breaking into things,
mm-hmm.
or circumventing controls, or things like that. Whereas the meaning of hacking, as used by pretty much every programmer I know, is all about taking repeated irregular blows at something, at a problem to solve it, or figure out a better way of using your data, or hooking one piece of software into another piece of software, one piece of hardware into another piece of hardware. So it's a positive thing. It's full participation in your devices, in your applications, your software, etc., and your media, rather than try to break into something and destroy it, as unfortunately the name hacks has come to be associated.
Certainly, hacking as it applies to Google is certainly not something that anybody really thinks of. And you've really kind of outlined many, many techniques that you can use to get more information out of Google. Google's a very simple website that generates search results. You guys have come up with about 100 techniques, is what it looks like, to get and extract information that you wouldn't normally think would be there. Why don't you kind of run through kind of the most popular ones that you guys outlined in your book?
Sure. So Google's simple search interface with just a simple little box, just like many search engines, actually works remarkably well. That's why Google is used by so many people.
Mm-hmm.
It returns intuitive results. It seems to almost know what you're looking for. But there are times when you want to alter your query slightly by adding things or removing things or altering things so that you can hone your results and find just what you're looking for. In those cases when it either doesn't return what you're looking for, else you want to get more specific.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that the data that it returns is incredibly useful for aggregating, sorting through, taking a look at, and just generally bending and spindling and figuring how trends may flow and what may be related to what you're looking for, etc. So what we do in the book is actually divided up into, not so hard and fast, but divided up into three main sections. The first one is all about how to hone your queries, how to alter the way that you search Google and its other properties to get better results. So, for example, there are actually some really advanced syntaxes that are not documented. You can do phone book queries and reverse phone book queries. You can put in a phone number, and it'll spit back, if it knows who it is, it'll spit back who the phone number belongs to. You can use wild cards so that you can put stand-ins for particular words, and if you know a phrase but you're not exactly sure of the phrasing but you want to find out who said it, you can use wild cards to break that out a little bit. You can play around with word order. You can play around with repetition. There are various little tips and techniques that you can use to actually go searching for specialized vocabularies, go searching for particular phrases, like I said, phone book, doc information, trying to narrow down where the sources of your results come from. So, for example, if you're just interested in what individuals rather than news corporations have to say about the war in Iraq right now, you could actually do a query and say, hey, I'm only interested in weblogs. That's done by a little bit of social engineering and noticing that all weblogs or most weblogs tend to have a little button down at the bottom or a little bit of text that says something like powered by Blogger or powered by Movable Type. So including that in your query and having, Iraq war powered by Blogger, you tend to see only the blog responses rather than the CNN response. So So that's the first part. The second part is all about programming the API. Now, Google released an API that's a programmatic interface to their database that allows your applications or your programs or your scripts to get access to Google's database in much the same manner as you as a human would through the web interface, which means that you can write to Google. You can write applications. As I said, one example of that was aggregating Google data over time. You can watch Windows versus Mac OS X over time to see how one goes up versus the other. One of the things that we have is capturing a moment in time. You can actually go through and use the date range syntax to return results from a particular date and time rather than just, you know, current setting. And there's even a little Java application which allows you to visualize the results. It actually goes to the Google API, gets data results, and shows them in a sort of this weird floating format that you can move around in and click on things and zoom in and all that sort of thing. It's rather interesting. And then, of course, the third part of the book is the webmastering side of Google, which is how to understand the PageRank algorithm, how to improve your visibility of your site in Google, and using AdWords, removing materials from Google if you don't want them there, etc. So it's an all-round. It's focused on the newbie as well as the regular searcher, as well as the programmer, and as well as the webmaster.
Does Google actually outline these things on their website itself? And if they don't, how did you actually get the information about how these things work on the inside of Google? Have you been talking to them, or is there some outside resource?
There are various resources. So on the one hand, Google doesn't actually show you all of the advanced syntaxes, and that is because they're trying to keep the interface simple. They're trying to keep to that one little box so that everybody can get the most out of Google without having to go through those contortions.
Yeah.
They do, on the other hand, provide a link to a more advanced interface, and if you go through and you read the source of that form that you can fill out, you can start gleaning some of the ways that the syntax works. But they don't. Most of the syntax is not documented by Google. It is indeed discussed in some of their related news groups. And also there are places like webmasterworld.com where people are spending an awful lot of time looking at how Google works and their page ranking algorithm and how it changes over time and search syntaxes, etc. In fact, my co-author Tara Cullishane is fabulous. She's been tracking this stuff for a long time. She has a site called researchbuzz.com. She does exactly that. She goes combing through things. She participates in Webmaster World and just basically digs through and brings out a lot of the syntax that she finds along the way and a lot of the tricks and tips that she finds in doing her own research that might be well applied to other people's research. She brought along some of those authors themselves, so we have a couple in here from people involved in Webmaster World talking about page ranking, etc.
Yeah, it certainly seems like there's techniques here that you guys have outlined that an everyday user can use to get better results. But one of the fascinating ones that I saw was using repeated words, the same words in the text box that you enter in your search query. Why does that generate a little different result? Now, I was noticing in your book that you're outlining that. Why do you think that happens?
We don't actually know. Google didn't tell us, but there are a couple. One of them is that if you put in, say, for example, the word rail, you'll get one set of results. If you put in the word rail, the two words rail, you will actually more likely to get pages that have the word rail twice in it versus word one. Another theory is that it's actually weighting the word rail. If you have rail and then twice and then some other words along with it, it'll weight the word that is repeated. And then a third theory, and this is actually somebody sent me an email last night about this, is that they noticed that when you do that, it tends to look for dual occurrences of these words, or more than one occurrence of these words in the same paragraph. So we don't exactly know, but it yields some more interesting results. And playing around in that sort of fashion, it really broadens your search and sometimes can lead you in directions you would never thought of going.
By looking through your list, that Google can make an excellent phone book, which is kind of unusual. You wouldn't think that it would have that kind of resource.
Yes, it does. It actually works remarkably well as well. So you can go ahead and put in, you can search for a business phone number, you can search for residential, or across both by using this simple syntax called phone book colon. And there's another one, B phone book colon and R phone book colon for business and residential. What you do is the format is basically phone book colon last name state. You can also put in first name if you wish, or city if you wish. There's a very simple syntax for doing that, and it'll find you phone books. So you can look up pizza joints in San Francisco if you'd like, or you can look up Smiths to see how many Smiths there are in Nebraska versus Florida. The reverse phone book lookup is kind of nice too. So if you if you ever get caller ID and you've got a number flashing there, if it's a listed number and Google has access to it, you can type that in and get the reverse lookup on it.
Yeah, one of the fun things about Google's is it's been this whole subculture that's generated about doing, you know, unusual searches like frugal and, you know, Google bombing and Google whacking and things like that. Could you talk about those a little bit? Why has that happened with Google, do you think?
I think because Google is this big, mysterious beastie that it's an oracle of sorts. You tell it what you want, and it returns back, and it's just fascinating. People are just dying to know how it works.
Yeah.
They're also dying to fiddle with it and try and change the way it works. There are some folks doing that. So in our book, we were always careful to do, for example, we cover Google whacking, which is, putting in the fewest number of words, and real words, and where you would end up with one result only. And it's incredibly hard to do, actually, because the combination of the words that have been used in pages is obviously huge. But at the same time, we don't cover Google bombing, which is something that people do. They exchange links, and they do all sorts of shenanigans to try and get a particular page or as a joke or, indeed, as business, trying to get their pages higher up in the Google rank. So one of the things that we really iterate over and over again, in the webmastering section, is the best way to please Google, the best way to have your page move up in the page rank is by producing fresh content and good content that people want to link to. It's as simple as that. But yeah, there are all sorts of shenanigans that have grown up around it. And I think it's very much a result of just not knowing how it works. And this mystery that people love to solve, and obviously it has great bearing on how visible you are to the world these days.
Yeah, and then also one of the other hacks that you have in here is actually working with the Google URL itself. So like up in the browser, instead of typing into the box, you can actually type in what keywords into the actual URL itself. Why would somebody want to do that versus using the actual text box?
Well, sometimes you get the results that you want, and if you happen to know how to do it, it's much easier than going back through and saying, okay, now I'll go back to the original box and figure out how to format my query to alter that. When it's a bit of hackerish business where you'd rather do it the quick and dirty and easy way rather than going and doing the proper way. So, for example, if you've got the results, just the results you're looking for, you can go to the advanced tab and set it so you want to see 100 results per page instead of 10. But you know, you really don't want to jump back and forth when you can just as easily change that in the actual URL itself. You can just append the number. You can say num equals 100, and off you go.
I mean, it sounds like just a shortcut that you can take to get to your results. We're having a conversation with Rael Dornfest, who's the co-author of Google Hacks. Rael is sharing some valuable and fun tips on how to get more info from Google when you do your searches. And his weblog is at www.raelty.org, and that's RAELITY.org. You're listening to Web Talk Guys Radio.
Recognize that sound? If you're taking vitamins in a pill form, that's exactly where they're ending up. Hello, my name is Dr. David Friedman. According to the physician's desk reference, vitamins in a pill form are just 10% absorbed. So for every $100 you spend on vitamins, you are literally flushing $90 of it down the toilet. If you want to start absorbing the nutrients you swallow, you need to take a product called Sea Silver. Not only does it contain every vitamin, mineral, amino acid, and enzyme known to man, but because it's in a natural liquid form, it offers a 98% absorption. That means your body gets to keep the nutrients you swallow. Try delicious-tasting Sea Silver today. You'll feel a difference or your money back. Call 1-800-285-8963. That's 1-800-285-8963. Isn't it time you stopped flushing your vitamins down the toilet? 1-800-285-8963.
Oh! Web Talk Radio is back. I'm Rob Greenlee. We're having a conversation with Rael Dornfest, who's the co-author of Google Hacks. Rael is sharing some valuable and fun tips on how to get more info from Google when you do your searches. One of the things that's been fascinating recently about Google is their movement towards looking at blogs, weblogs, as a resource, you know, with their acquisition of Blogger.com.
Yes.
How do you think that's going to affect the potential search results for a Google? And if you look out now, I know your book doesn't really cover that, but I would think it has a little bit of an impact on all that.
Yeah, well, blogs themselves have had an impact on Google. I mean, Google bombing sort of came out of some fun experimentation in blogs with, if you have thousands of people all pointing to the same resource,
yeah,
or with the same link terms, that way you have a chance to influence Google. I think that, you know, your blogs, they tend to change more rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to find those things that might have taken a spider a while to find. And, you know, obviously they know what's current, right? These are people here saying, I know what's current, what's most important in the world, and what's most interesting, at least to my circle of friends. Whereas the spider just, you know, it just comes across data, and data is data. Now, obviously Google does a lot more than that to try and figure out what's relevant and what's important. But at the same time, you know, there's nothing like a human to figure out what's interesting. While, you know, obviously I don't know what they have planned for Blogger, I would guess that they're going to be really focusing on blogs as being early warning systems for upcoming issues or things that are hot right now.
Oh, interesting.
As ways of steering the spiders and saying, hey, you know, you're in the dark recesses of some, you know, web page way over there, whereas there's something really hot going on right now over here. There seems to be a lot of update and a lot of activity. You know, steer the spider back over here, or send out new spiders, obviously, back over here and see what's going on. So blogs can definitely identify the hot spots on the net for, you know, quite a vast array of subjects and circles of people who are interested in it.
One thing that I use with Google a lot, and I don't know if this can be used with your techniques itself, but is the toolbar.
Yes.
And it seems like that's been a real differentiation. I know it's had an impact on how often I use Google. I mean, you know, when I had that installed, it's there all the time. And can these techniques be used within the toolbar as well?
Yes. So the toolbar takes all the standard syntax bits and bobs that you would type into, mm-hmm, the regular search box. So in that respect, well, you know, most of the little tips and tools that we have at the beginning will do fit fine. They have some buttons and things that you can use to hone stuff without needing to necessarily use special syntaxes. And, of course, there's the page rank, which comes along with the Google bar, which is rather nice. So you can actually take a look at whatever page you're on, take a look at where it falls in the page ranking system. And you can also see what's related without having to go through it. In the regular search box, you can always say related, colon, and put in the URL, and it'll tell you what's related. But it's nice if that pops up in a little box for you. But as far as the search box is concerned, yes, you can use it. You know, I haven't really found anything that you can't use in there, that you would use in the regular search box.
Now, if a person wanted to have information about themselves removed from Google, are there some techniques? And I thought I saw a few mentions in your book about techniques that you can use to remove content, too. Maybe people are concerned about their privacy or that there's a page up there that they don't want to have linked within Google.
Yeah. Well, the best technique for getting your stuff removed from Google is actually not having Google find it in the first place.
Or just take it down off of the web server, right?
Yeah, well, there are other ways to do it. One of them is that Google is, it does obey these spider rules. There have been a set of spider rules that have been around for ages now about the web, saying, listen, if you're Google, I don't want you in here. Or if you're Google, I want you in here, but not that often. Or, hey, you can look at these pages, but not these pages, or this file type, but not that file type. So making sure that they're not indexed is actually the best way to do that, because it's just, you know, it's just then you have to go through and you have to say, now Google remove this, and now Alta Vista remove this, and Yahoo, etc. It's actually a lot more difficult than you would think in terms of across different search engines. Once you've had the pages indexed, you can actually, there are ways to contact Google to say, hey, I want to have that stuff removed. There's actually a site you can go to. Other people can actually report to Google on inappropriate content that may not have been found by their content filter.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that you can do a safe search where you're guarding against seeing, you know, anything of explicit nature or sexual nature. But Google sometimes will not notice that and will put some result through when you're doing a safe search that is indeed what they would call safe. So you can actually report that content too. So there are some inroads there, but again, the best way to do it is just, you know, be smart about your website and learn about things like robots exclusion rule and apply them if you really want to hide bits of your site from Google and indeed, you know, the rest of the web and the search engines.
Yeah, one of the major techniques that a lot of people use with search engines just in general is the use of quotation marks in the text field. Is there any special techniques that a user should use when using quotation marks in Google specifically?
Not really. I mean, just in general across search engines, quotation marks generally signify that you want to see these words together rather than, so me thinks thou dost protest too much. You know, Google actually is remarkably good anyway without the quotation mark at being able to find those. But if, for example, it weren't that common a phrase, but you do want to see those two words right next to each other, telling Google that with quotation marks is can be effective. But as I said before, it's less useful with Google than it is with some other engines who just assume otherwise that you're not looking for those. And, you know, tend to be keyword-focused rather than phrase-focused.
Yeah, because most people don't even know to use quotation marks, so it's not something that they really emphasized in their scripts.
Yeah.
Google does have a limit of how many words you can type into the text search box, right? I think it's like 10, I think is what I noticed.
It has a 10-word limit,
like that. There's some techniques that the book outlines that I saw that can help you kind of use more than that if you need to. But I guess my question is, why would you ever need to use more than 10?
Well, so if you're doing things like, it's not just the 10 words in your query itself, it's the 10 words, it includes things like special syntaxes you might use, right?
Okay.
So if you're looking for something, some keyword somewhere, and you want to exclude all .com domains, including include .edu domain, and you don't want anything that has this on the page or that. You know, it grows pretty quickly. You can use up those 10 keywords very, very quickly. So one of the techniques to get around that is to think that you're looking for, trying to hone it down to the most unobvious words. So again, using the phrase "methinks thou dost protest too much," you would actually search for "dost protest too much." You wouldn't use. Necessarily me, and you wouldn't use necessarily the lady at the end of the phrase. You would use what is most likely to find you unusual results, and unusual is usually more focused. Another thing you can do is use the wild card, the star character, to block out words. So you can use them to replace all the, if you have a phrase that has the word I in it a lot, or me, those tend to be stop words that Google doesn't really care about anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You can put stars in there instead, or asterisk, and that will, it'll put placeholders into that phrase, but at the same time, those don't actually count towards the 10-word limit.
Oh, okay. So, using natural language, would you say that that's an effective technique with Google, or should you just use specific keyword phrases or keywords that maybe don't flow as a sentence form, but just give Google what they need to find what you're looking for?
Yes, because, you know, there was Ask Jeeves, who actually... they push forward with natural language. Google Google does okay with natural language. I'd rather put in search query terms that are more to the point. It actually turns out that's remarkably good at is if you just take a sentence and you strip out all the unnecessary bits and put in just the bits you're looking for. So you wouldn't say, where can I find vegetarian cooking? But if you put in vegetarian cooking, it makes sense. Or where can I find vegetarian cooking recipes? You can put in vegetarian cooking recipes at that part of the sentence, and you'll find what you're looking for usually. So it's just stripping out the unnecessary bits. But you know, generally the queries are pretty simple and straightforward. You just use whatever keywords you think are most apropos to the subject you're using. You don't really, with Google, you don't really have to think too much about what are the keywords that Google would think would be associated with this topic. It's more about, you know, because the page ranking is based upon real people using real words. So if you're thinking, these are the words I would associate it with, it, chances are that most of the people linking to that resource have done the same, and chances are you'll find it by just using those keywords.
So does Google prioritize the first word in any query that you do over the second word? Does it have a hierarchy?
It doesn't, supposedly, but we found another little thing that we can't really explain, but we did find was that that permuting a query, so changing the order of everything in the query, does yield some different results, not all the time, but sometimes. It's one of those techniques where if you're not sure where to go from where you are, you're not sure what to do to hone down your query, the results you're getting are kind of what you're looking for, but you kind of want to see more. It's a way of just if you switch some of the words around, you tend to find some results you hadn't seen before, and you tend to see some flow to the top that weren't necessarily near the top before. Again, we don't know why that works, but it does. It does for a certain value of does, that is.
Why don't you tell us how a person can find out some more information about the book? And actually, you've got, I think, what, 10 or so, or quite a few actually, of the hacks available online that a person can go look at just as a sample?
We do. The possibly the easiest URL is to remember is hacks.o'reilly.com.
Okay.
And that is a community site that we've built around the books, and they have obviously information about the books and where to buy them and how to buy them. They also have a list of all the hacks in the book, some of the content there, as well as you know, some number of fully exposed hacks from the book. So we have a few up there per book. Mm-hmm. And also a way to read contributed hacks as well as contribute your own hacks. So, you know, whether on Google or on, we have other Mac OS X, Linux Server, or indeed suggest a book that you'd like to see and propose some hacks for that. And then there's also a discussion attached to that. So you can go ahead and discuss some of the hacks. And many people have been saying, hey, I found this worked better than that, or this doesn't work for me, what am I doing wrong? Or, you know, here's a little script that makes things easier. So, yeah, hacks.o'reilly.com is probably the best place to go.
Oh, terrific. You know, I was just looking through your list of hacks, and I came across one here. It's scraping Google AdWords.
Yes.
The term scraping is a new one to me. What is that?
So scraping was indeed the first web service, if you will.
Uh-huh.
Scraping was taking going to a web page, viewing the source, and that was an incredibly powerful thing that was added to browsers from the very beginning was the View Source button, which allows you to expose the HTML code beneath the surface of the web page you're looking at, and you know, use it to learn about HTML and use it to find specific things. But what people started doing programmatically was looking for patterns and finding patterns to extract programmatically,
mm-hmm.
and so you could extract the data out from the presentation format and get rid of all those bold and italic tags and paragraph markers and all that, and actually use the data. So people were going around, you could in 5 minutes, I could write a scraper that would actually go and scrape Google's front page, and I could do my search results that way, and that way I don't have to, you know, if the API weren't available, I could actually get to the data without having to go to the web page all the time. At least I could do it programmatically. Now, Google discourages that, and indeed put out their API instead of that, saying, hey, listen, here's a really useful interface to this. We don't have to do all that scraping. The problem with scraping being that every time the person who's maintaining the page goes and changes anything, pretty much anything, they add a bold tag or they remove a bold tag or they reformat the page somehow, the scraper fails. It's an incredibly brittle thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So the preferable route is obviously going through an API. But for things like AdWords or news or groups or the directory, the sort of things that Google doesn't provide access to in their API, you can actually scrape some of that stuff in a rather useful fashion. It's against their acceptable use policy to go ahead and automate that, have something spider that on a regular basis and bring it in and scrape it and put it into your database.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you visit the page using your browser and you find something particularly interesting with some results that you really want to save, you know, you can save that HTML page to your desktop, run a little, tiny little Perl script on it, and have it spit out the results in a format that can be imported into Excel, for example, so that you can actually have that data available to you without saying, okay, well, I've got this page stored somewhere, now I can open that up and read it again. So we do provide some information on scraping, and we do provide, obviously, warnings against doing that in an automated fashion. And some, you know, kind and gentle ways of doing that for the data that you're looking for that may not be available via the API.
One other of those that I've noticed that you had is the ability to integrate spell checking into Microsoft Word using Google. That was kind of a fascinating one. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. There's a little application that you can download that Cape Clear created. They're a company, and they just created this little application you download. It's for Windows, for Microsoft Word. You know, just it's a point-and-click installation, basically, a little bit of fiddling. And then you can have Microsoft Word make use of Google Spell Checker in addition to the built-in. The advantage of Google Spell Checker is based upon, and we talked about this a little earlier, is actual word usage.
Mm-hmm.
So while the word processor, Microsoft Word, the built-in dictionary might not know anything about the spelling of Britney Spears, and in fact you can spell it as Britney Spires, it will, you know, it might think there's a grammatical error, but as far as spelling is concerned, the two words are independently spelled correctly. Whereas if you throw that through Google says, hey, I think you're probably talking about Britney Spears. It's word usage patterns that you can search for instead. Say if you misspell, if you put in Rail Dornfest and you misspell part of that, whereas the word spell checker would find something wrong with both those words and not know what you're talking about, or might indeed find that, you know, spelling it R-E-A-L is actually perfectly legitimate even though it's wrong, Google would come up and say, hey, there are an awful lot of pointers to something called Raildornfest, some guy out there. You might want to use that instead. Mm-hmm. So it's rather nice, actually.
So is there a way of running a query against Google that will generate a list of keywords that are the most popular for a particular phrase?
No. Google does have as part of their API, when you put in your query, any results that have categories associated with them. Mm-hmm. You know, they've hooked up through to the Yahoo directory. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you find a result that happens to be in the Yahoo directory under some category, vegetarian cooking, for example, it will actually provide that information to you. So that's a rather useful thing. I haven't used it extensively, but mm-hmm. it is provided.
Yeah, it seems like that would be a benefit to somebody that's trying to create a campaign within the AdWords sponsored link program.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the interesting thing that we did with scraping Google AdWords was it was useful for if you type in a bunch of your the queries that you would expect to yield results for, you know, the kind of results that you're looking for to associate with your company or your Google AdWords, you can scrape those through and see what other companies or products are associated with that query. So there is sort of a way of doing some market analysis that way before you go ahead and propose your Google AdWords. Doing that programmatically and scraping it is a little easier than going page by page by page and just reading all these and, you know, copying and pasting.
That's terrific. Rail, it was terrific having you on the show with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Hearing about your book, Google Hacks, and how long has Google Hacks been out on the market? Is it available in the bookstores now?
Oh, yes. Yes, it is. It's available at online bookstores, brick and mortar, everywhere. It's doing rather well, actually.
Well, that's terrific. I'm sure it's available at Amazon.com, so if somebody wanted to get it online.
It is. It is the 10th best-selling book currently at Amazon overall, which is as of today.
Wow, that's terrific. Are there any other websites that a listener can go to find out more information about you and follow your tracking of hacking with Google?
Sure. Well, there's obviously the hacks.o'reilly.com yep. site. There's also Tara Cullishane. She's at researchbuzz.com. She's my co-author. And I maintain a weblog at reality.org, R-A-E-L-I-T-Y.org, which has something to do with Google and nothing to do with Google.
Okay, terrific. Well, thanks again.
Sure thing.
And good luck out there, and we'll be following your book.
Thank you very much.
Okay, have a great weekend.
You too.
We've been speaking with Rael Dornfest, who is a co-author of Google Hacks, which is published by O'Reilly. You can find more of Rael's writings at Reality Bytes. That is his weblog site at www.raelity.org. And you can find more info about his book at hacks.o'reilly.com.
Thank you very much for listening to Web Talk Guys this week. That's it for our show this week. But Rob and I will be back here bringing you more glimpses into the future of the Internet.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.